The headlines, Iran says the West's haste to reach a deal on the revival of the JCPOA cannot prevent the observance of its red lines. NATO rejects calls for imposing a no-fly zone over Ukraine, saying it's not part of the conflict. And at least 56 people are killed in a suicide attack on a Shia mosque in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the Iranian foreign minister says his country is ready to immediately finalize a good agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. But he stresses that the West's haste cannot prevent Tehran from observing its red lines. Hossein Amir Abdollahian was speaking with top EU diplomat Josep Borrell on the phone. Amir Abdollahian said the announcement of a possible deal rests upon fulfillment of Iran's demands, including guarantees for its effective implementation. The top Iranian diplomat said he will head to Vienna whenever the West agrees to observe his country's red lines. Josep Borrell, on his part, said the JCPOA revival talks taking place in Vienna are improving and nearing final results. Homa Lezgi is joining us now from the Austrian capital, Vienna, with all the latest updates. Homa, what do you have to share with us?
Yes, Fadio. The news that we have right now is that the E3 negotiators, so the key representatives of Britain, France and Germany, are heading back to their capitals for what seems to be brief consultations with their ministers before returning. We had a tweet by the UK representative, Stephanie Algar, where she said, "We are close to reaching a final agreement," and that the E3 negotiators are leaving Vienna briefly, and quoting her, to update the ministers on the state of play, but they are ready to return soon. At the same time, sources close to the Iranian team have been telling us that Mr. Barghari and his team are staying put here in Vienna for the time being. The E3 negotiators are expected to be back very soon, and if indeed the decision is made, there is an expectation for the foreign ministers to be here in Vienna for the final announcement and to make that final announcement. You just referred there to the comments by the Iranian foreign minister, Mr. Amir Abdollahian, saying that he is also prepared to come if, of course, the remaining issues are resolved. And when we are talking about the prospect for these talks, how long it's still going to take, if there is even a possibility of a collapse or not, Russian Ambassador Mikhail Oryanov last night was saying that he doesn't think it's going to collapse at this stage. They are so close to the finish line now. However, this doesn't mean, both Iranians have said this, the Americans have said this, that there is an agreement. Some issues still remain. We're hearing that one of them is, of course, the issue of claims regarding Iran's nuclear activities. IAEA Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi heading to Tehran now to discuss a roadmap for those issues. But there is also, we're hearing, the issue of economic guarantees that Iran is seeking. Today we had various meetings, including one between the Iranian team with the presence of the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister for Economic Affairs, Mr. Safari, alongside the head of the Iranian delegation, Mr. Barghari, with the E3 representatives, which were supposedly focused on that issue among other outstanding remaining issues. So we'll have to see. Some sources, even the Russian ambassador Mikhail Oryanov, said that a final decision with the presence of the foreign ministers could happen on Saturday, Sunday or Monday. I think the decision is one to be made by the negotiators themselves based upon where they're standing, but it is a very delicate and sensitive time now, and we might very soon hear the final decision.
Thanks a lot, Homa Lezgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal, coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alcock, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all.
The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says U.S. violation of its obligations and European inaction have made it inevitable for Iran to push for a credible, balanced and lasting agreement in Vienna. Ali Shamkhani called on the U.S. administration to learn lessons from its predecessor and not lose the opportunity to strike a good agreement. A blaze broke out overnight at a major Ukrainian nuclear plant as a result of a strike. This is how the UN nuclear chief has described the incident.
Overnight, a projectile hit a building within the plant site, within the site of the plant. This building, I should repeat, is not part of the reactor. Is none of the reactors is a training adjacent construction facility to the reactors. This caused a localized fire, which was extinguished.
Grassi said there was no release of radiation and the integrity of the reactors at Zaporizhia nuclear power plant was not compromised. However, the IAEA chief expressed extreme concern about the situation, which he said remains very challenging. Moscow has described the incident as a horrible provocation staged by Ukraine's nationalist regime. It says Ukrainian saboteurs set fire to the facility as they retreated following a battle with Russian troops near Europe's biggest power plant. Kiev, however, blamed Russia for the incident and accused Moscow of resorting to nuclear terror. President Vladimir Zelensky says Russia wants to repeat the Chernobyl disaster that happened 36 years ago.
I appeal to all Ukrainians, to all Europeans, to all people who know the word Chernobyl, who know how much grief and casualties the explosion at the nuclear power plant brought. It was a global catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of people struggled with its consequences. Tens of thousands of people were evacuated. Russia wants to repeat this and is already repeating it.
There have also been strong Western reactions to the incident. NATO says the attack shows the recklessness of Russia's military operation and the importance of ending it. U.S. President Joe Biden has urged Russia to stop its military activities in Ukraine and allow in emergency services. In a phone call with Zelensky, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned that Putin's, quote, reckless actions could directly threaten the safety of all of Europe. Johnson said London would do everything it could to ensure the situation would not worsen further. NATO rejects Kiev's calls for imposing a no-fly zone over Ukraine amid Russia's military operation in the country.
On a no-fly zone, it was mentioned. At the same time, allies agree that we should not have NATO planes operating over Ukrainian airspace or NATO troops on Ukrainian territory. We are not part of this conflict, and we have a responsibility to ensure it does not escalate and spread beyond Ukraine, because that would be even more devastating and more dangerous. with even more human suffering. NATO is not seeking a war with Russia.
Stoltenberg announced the, quote, painful decision after an urgent meeting with NATO foreign ministers. He said enforcing a no-fly zone would entail sending NATO fighter jets into Ukraine's airspace and shooting down Russian planes. He warned that the measure would end in a full-fledged war in Europe involving many more countries and causing much more human suffering. Stoltenberg also insisted that NATO is a defensive alliance with a core task of keeping its member states safe. Washington has already ruled out implementing a no-fly zone over Ukraine, saying such a move would lead to an all-out war between the U.S. and Russia. A powerful blast rips through Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar. Hospital officials say these 56 people have been killed and dozens of others injured. Many of those injured are said to be in critical condition. The explosion happened inside a mosque when worshippers were holding Friday prayers. The area around the mosque was also packed with people. Police have cordoned off the blast site. They say it was a suicide bombing. No group has yet claimed responsibility. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has condemned the deadly attack. Meanwhile, Iran has strongly condemned the deadly bomb attack that targeted a mosque in the Pakistani city of Peshawar. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the attack was aimed at sowing discord among Muslims. Saeed Khatibzadeh urged Pakistani officials to take necessary and firm measures to prevent criminal activities of terrorists. He also offered condolences to the families of the victims and wished swift recovery for those who were injured in the attack. And the number of daily COVID cases continues to drop in Iran as the country presses ahead with its ongoing national vaccination campaign. Figures from Iran's health ministry shows nearly 6,500 new cases have been detected in the past 24 hours. The new figure raises the country's total caseload to over 7 million. Also, the disease has taken the lives of 154 people in the same period. The relative decline is largely attributed to the country's mass vaccination drive. According to health officials, over 142 million COVID jabs have so far been administered across the country. Iran faced a sixth wave of the pandemic in mid-January. The uptick was largely blamed on the highly contagious Omicron variant of the virus. French President Emmanuel Macron says he will run for a second term in the elections next month. Macron has said he's not achieved everything he set out to do during his first term that began in May 2017. He has promised to cut taxes and hinted at education reforms. According to a recent poll, around 37% of the French people approved of Macron. That's lower than 62% approval rating the president enjoyed after he was first elected. Apart from challenges related to the COVID pandemic, Macron has faced growing public discontent with rising fuel prices and subsequent protests by the Yellow Vests. Another challenge is the Ukraine conflict. Macron had tried to play a mediatory role in the West tensions with Russia. As Moscow and Kiev are embroiled in a military conflict inside Ukraine, many have shifted the focus towards civilians and how the war affects them. But controversies have arisen over what is seen as racist approaches and double standards when describing the Ukrainian people and the situation they face.
Western media coverage of the conflict in Ukraine has come under the spotlight over what's seen as racist comments by journalists and their guests talking about the crisis affecting the Ukrainian people.
Me, I'm sorry, it's really emotional for me because I see European people with blue eyes and blonde hair being killed, children being killed every day with Putin's missiles and his helicopters and his rockets.
And so, of course, I understand and respect the emotion.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
We're not talking here about Syrians fleeing the bombing of the Syrian regime backed by Putin. We're talking about Europeans living in cars that look like ours to save their lives.
People across the world were quick to react to those comments.
I support Ukraine. I'm also upset at Western leaders for being hypocritical when it comes to taking action for Yemen and Palestine. A Ukrainian's life isn't worth any more or less than that of a Palestinian or Yemeni. We are all equal. We must condemn war everywhere. If you support Ukraine but not Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, if you condemn Russia but not Israel and the U.S., then congratulations, mate. You're on the highest tier of hypocrisy. Where were NATO, the USA, and their people when Israel was killing innocent Palestinian children? It's not Ukraine. It's Gaza. But no one stands for them.
Social media platforms have also been filled with comments criticizing different approaches by European countries in dealing with refugees. The Ukrainians fleeing the conflict in their country have received a warm welcome by their neighbors, including Poland. No problem with that. But these European states had a totally different stance back in 2015, when an influx of refugees escaping poverty and violence in Africa and the Middle East reached Europe. Some European authorities have even drawn a distinct line between the two groups of people.
These are not the refugees we are used to. Ukrainian people are Europeans. These people are intelligent. They are educated people. This is not the refugee wave we have been used to. People we were not sure about their identity. People with unclear pasts who could have been even terrorists.
Race and nationality again become important when people fleeing the Ukraine war are received. There have been reports of Africans being turned away at the border by security forces. Some of the journalists that were caught red-handed ended up apologizing for being, quote, insensitive. But questions remain that whether being a European means the mainstream media will be more likely to talk about their distress. Many may now hope that having darker skin or being from a certain religion doesn't make others ignore their pain and suffering.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Senator Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, effectively killed President Biden's signature domestic policy bill in its current form on Sunday, 19th of December, saying he was convinced the spending and tax cuts in the $2.2 trillion legislation will exacerbate already hot inflation. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jim Tankersley. The piece is titled, The Path Ahead for Biden, Overcome Manchin's Inflation Fears. Senator Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, effectively killed President Biden's signature domestic policy bill in its current form on Sunday, 19th of December, saying he was convinced the spending and tax cuts in the $2.2 trillion legislation would exacerbate already hot inflation. Economic evidence, though, strongly suggests that Joe Manchin is wrong. A host of economists and independent analyses have concluded that the bill is not economic stimulus and that it will not pump enough money into consumer pocketbooks next year to raise prices more than a modest amount. The reason has to do with the pace at which the bill spends money and how much it raises through tax increases that are intended to pay for that spending. The legislation spends funds over a decade, allowing the taxes it raises on wealthy Americans and businesses, which will siphon money out of the economy to help counteract the boost from spending and tax cuts. The bill also does not provide the type of direct stimulus included in the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid package that Joe Biden signed in March, and which Mr. Manchin supported. Some of its provisions would give money directly to people, like a continued expanded child tax credit, but others fund programs that would take time to ramp up, like universal pre-kindergarten. Economists say the net result is likely to be, at most, a tenth of a percentage point or two increase in the inflation rate. That would be a relatively small effect at a time when supply chain crunches, surging global oil demand, and a pandemic shift among consumers away from travel and dining out and towards durable goods have combined to raise the annual inflation rate to 6.8%, its fastest pace in nearly 40 years. For months, Senator Manchin has warned the president and congressional leaders that he was uncomfortable with the breadth of what had become a $2.2 trillion bill to fight climate change, continue monthly checks to parents, establish universal pre-kindergarten, and invest in a wide range of spending and tax cuts, targeting childcare, affordable housing, home health care, and more. He has cited both the risks of inflation and his fear that the package could further balloon the federal budget deficit, saying several programs that are now estimated to end in a few years would likely be made permanent. Over the past week, Senator Manchin has insisted that the bill should shrink to fit the framework of less than $2 trillion that Joe Biden announced this fall, and that, crucially, the legislation not use budget gimmicks to artificially lower the bill's effect on the budget deficit. In a statement on Sunday, 19th of December, Senator Manchin said Democrats continue to camouflage the real cost of the intent behind this bill. White House officials have tried to promote the idea that the bill would reduce price pressures right away, an outcome that economists have not entirely bought into. But the general economic consensus finds little evidence to suggest the bill risks exacerbating rising food, rising gasoline, and other prices. Today's inflationary surge stems from a confluence of factors, many of them related to the pandemic. The coronavirus pandemic has caused factories to shutter and clogged ports, disrupting the supply of goods that Americans stuck at home have wanted to buy, like electronics goods, televisions, and home furnishings. That high demand has been fueled in part by consumers who are flush with cash after months of lockdown and repeated government payments, including stimulus checks. Research from the Federal Reserve has shown that inflation is most likely getting a temporary increase from the coronavirus relief package in March, which included $1,400 direct checks to families and generous unemployment benefits. But President Biden's social policy bill would do relatively little to spur increased consumer spending next year, and not enough to offset the loss of government stimulus to the economy as pandemic aid expires. White House aides have tried to make the case to Senator Manchin and the public in recent weeks, pointing to a series of analyses that have dismissed inflationary fears pegged to the bill. That includes analysis from a pair of Democratic economists who warned about rising inflation earlier this year. Harvard University's Lawrence Summers and Jason Furman, and from the nonpartisan Penn Wharton budget model at the University of Pennsylvania. All of those analyses conclude that the bill would add little or nothing to inflation in the coming year. The disconnect between economic reality and Senator Joe Manchin's stated concerns has exasperated the White House, which is struggling with voter discontent towards Joe Biden over rising prices, as well as an unyielding pandemic. In a scathing statement about Senator Manchin on Sunday, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki noted that the Penn Wharton analysis found that Joe Biden's bill will have virtually no impact on inflation in the short term, and in the long run, the policies it includes will ease inflationary pressures. White House officials, who along with party leaders have spent weeks trying to bring Senator Joe Manchin to a place of comfort with Joe Biden's bill, registered a sense of betrayal after the senator's declaration. Jen Psaki said Senator Manchin had last week personally submitted to the president an outline for a bill that was the same size and scope as the president's framework and covered many of the same priorities. He had also promised to continue discussions towards an agreement, she said. Republicans celebrated Senator Manchin's statement as evidence that the bill, which Democrats were attempting to pass along party lines, was full of inflationary policies that even the president's own party could not get behind. Still, Senator Manchin's concerns leave the White House at least the possibility of a path forward, albeit not the one that President Biden set out to travel. Some Democrats and administration officials believe there is still a chance to recast the bill to suit Senator Manchin's demands and to possibly pass it in the early months of next year. The result would be a bill that would also be unlikely to fuel inflation next year, but which would be smaller. The number of programs it would contain would shrink, and it would include funding over the next 10 years to pay for the spending. Such changes would force the White House to once again make difficult choices about which party priorities to leave on the cutting room floor. President Biden began the year with a $4 trillion agenda to overhaul the government's role in the economy, fight climate change, and invest in America's children. He sliced off some of it for a bipartisan infrastructure bill he signed into law this fall, and has whittled down the rest of negotiations with moderates and progressives in his party, which controls the House and Senate by exceedingly narrow margins. As they scaled back the bill, Democratic leaders had essentially two choices. They could either focus on a few programs like tax credits for climate change and expanded benefit for parents that is meant to fight child poverty, and making pre-kindergarten free for 3- and 4-year-olds across the country. Or they could pack as many programs as possible into the bill, setting some of them to expire after as little as a year to avoid ballooning the budget deficit and hope that lawmakers would extend them in the future. Leaders chose the pack-it-in strategy, in part because so many interest groups in their coalition, like environmentalists and labor unions, had competing priorities. Budget hawks urged a more targeted approach, fewer programs that were made permanent to avoid paying budget gains that could fuel the deficit down the road.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen from each and every single corner of the world, hope everything is just fine with you. Whatever you're doing, driving your car, walking on your feet, going back to home after a long day, or just resting at home, I welcome your entrance to an extraordinary zone. You're hearing me from IRB English Radio. Get ready to fly with us in the realm of reality with a new episode of your program, Back to Reality. This is Asma at your service as your host, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Habib. Very happy to have you both in here.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm also happy to be with you always.
Yes, I'm always glad to be with you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on board.
Yes, thank you for being here. Welcome to your program. So give us just a little bit about yourself, an introduction. Zainab, what are you studying?
Well, Asma, I'm Zainab Askari, and I'm a student of Hausa right now, and I'm done with Master's in Linguistics from University of Kashmir.
Linguistics is awesome. Okay, you, brother?
Currently studying in the Hausa, Kharij level, advanced level, and at your service.
That's so much, you're a master. Today we're going to talk about some interesting stuff, which is going to be about how to make the need for religion in someone. Is it really needed to be religious?
Not only is it needed, but it's something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created us on, with the nature of human beings, creatures that want to reach perfection. And the only way to reach perfection is by following a religion. Whether you state that religion is your own mind or intellect, such as the Greek people state, or whether it's, for example, by doing this kind of exercise and that kind of exercise, or whether it's by following this person or following that person, at the end of the day, human beings are running towards their perfection, and perfection cannot be followed or reached or achieved unless you have that religion, that path. Because what is religion other than
path?
Some
people would tell you that there is no need to have a religion. I would go toward perfection, and there is no need for religion.
What is their thought about perfection? Their perfection is, for example, to live this liberal life or this communist life. So therefore, their religion, whether they like it or not, is the laws that the state puts upon them. It's what they follow. It's that lifestyle that they're taking, that they believe is something that will help the not only them, but their society reach to perfection.
Okay, Sister Zainab, join us.
Yeah, sure. He's so interesting. Whenever Brother Habib is there, I always love to just listen.
Thank you very much. I feel humble right now.
Yeah. So I think a religion is a set of rules that teaches you a way of life. And set of rules is extremely important.
Say you have children, and it's a rather personal question. How you teach them to have a religion? It's very difficult to teach the people who have no idea about religion that religion is something we need. It's a crucial part of our life.
I have been teaching my children religion since they have just, you know, opened their eyes.
How? How you do that? How you make them feel like there is a need to be religious?
You are teaching them a way of life. You're teaching them a like, you know. For example, we sit together and we are having food. The best way to have food, you know, what is religion? Religion is telling me, start with the name of Allah. Start with the name of Allah. Mm-hmm. Just know who gave you this food. And then chew it well. What does science say? Chew it well. What do other, like, you know, sciences or, I don't know, health magazines and all say? If you do not chew your food well, you're going to have this and that problem. Religion says sit properly. Mm-hmm. Have your weight on the left side of your body.
So
sit
you mean to live better, we have
to... Each and every single, for example...
set of rules.
Yeah, you cannot tell a child... A child cannot say, I can just grow up without the care of my parents, without the care of my mother and father and, you know, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. A child cannot grow up. He needs someone to teach him, like, you know, even we are social beings, yeah?
Yes.
We are social beings and we are living in a society where we have set of rules. We cannot say just, I want to drive and I don't want to follow traffic rules. Why we have traffic rules? Why we have any rules? Why we have state rules? Mm-hmm. Why does every state have a law?
Because things are
because
not
we are social beings.
Be
we are living in a society,
done,
yeah. And while you're living in a society, you have to follow a certain kind of rules. But we are seeing these rules made for humans by humans are always they always end up with, you know, I cannot follow a state law which was made 40 years back. They always change. They always have changed. Why they have changed? Because a human being is not a perfect writer of this law. So this, the one who created this human being,
very nice.
The one who created this human being can write a perfect law for him. My intellect is not that much that I can write a law for myself. While I'm creating a washing machine, while I'm creating a refrigerator, I am writing its, instruction book. Because
so
I'm the creator of this.
I would ask you a question. Then why does it have to be coming from heaven? Why do we have to have prophets? Why it must be heavenly, coming from Allah?
Like how my sister beautifully put, that the person, that the thing that created you mm-hmm. is the one that best knows you. Therefore, he is the one that sets the guidelines. And then the second question that pops up, all right, if the laws are not from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then from whom?
You know, through the history of the world, many people have set some rules.
All right, let's start off with from Adam. Go down from Adam. Adam had children. Why did he choose this child over that child to be the ruler after him, or to one, the one that gives out laws after him? Why should we, for example, put two people and then vote for these two people? I want to run for president. That's the first thing I come up for arguments. I want to run for president. I want to be the ruler. What are you going to do about it? So therefore, why is this person ruler and that person not a ruler? Is it because of power? Who says that the person who has power and the person that has more people with him, a stronger army, is the person that is a rightful ruler?
Mm-hmm.
There has to be a ruler who is able to not only give out a justice order, but also have that touch with that divine knowledge that understands human beings as it is.
So you mean that an ordinary person cannot set rules? An ordinary human being is
yes,
not
the intellect
able.
Of human beings, and that is why the Greeks, they created qanun, or what is it called?
Yeah,
mantak, logic. Logic.
Don't go anywhere. We'll join you in a minute.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
So let's go back to reality with today's discussion.
Us human beings, we want to reach perfection. But how do we reach perfection? With knowledge. Our knowledge is able of falling into mistakes. And that is why they brought up mantiq, or logic, to fix up their mistakes. And that's what we study in logic. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has told us something else. That us human beings, if we follow our hawa, various verses about this, if we follow what
we
desire.
Can you explain more about hawa?
Desires. Like, for example, if this person is a ruler,
mm-hmm.
he has these desires of, for example, bringing in more cash. The greed, the wealth, or the lust, or any other bad, characteristic that has, that he tries to bring it for himself and forgets society when he rules. And we have that a lot. And we have various examples of this. The greedy forget there's no justice.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, there's no justice. So the person that rules has to be a person that is totally just. And how do we know that this person is totally just? By Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala putting him as the true authority. And that's the idea of imamat.
Yeah.
That is the reason why we say Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam is the true caliph after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
The first fact is to believe that there must be rules, set of rules.
Of course,
and
otherwise, like
rules,
how my sister put it out, there will be chaos.
Yes, and right? Those rules have to come from a heavenly chosen authority.
Because otherwise desires will come and play roles. For example, if I'm a ruler, and I like Liverpool, for example, I would try to make the transfer market better for Liverpool so they could
personal
buy better
impressions
players.
Impressions would do a lot.
Yes,
then,
yes. So there has to be a person that is totally just.
Yes.
And trust me, there is no one except for Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
Exactly. So then I would be a person from the other side of the world, and I'm telling you that there are many leaders in this world.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be a very perfect people, like they are human beings. I've watched actually many of them in YouTube or somewhere else. They speak very well. They seem to be like doing everything perfectly, and they lead people into a good life. You know, you have seen something like this as well, perhaps. Why not following these people?
Because human knowledge is limited. And we always want to go towards perfection. Like I said, why cannot, for example, as a non-living...
You know, I mean, many people would tell you it does not have to be something sacred, something that is related to religion. I would want to be a good
then
person.
Then why no country is happy with the state laws? Why no country is happy with the traffic laws? With the
as a person living, I don't want to say liberal, you know. I'm living life like a human being. I want to be perfect and I would follow a pattern. I would be only a good human being. I won't do some bad stuff. Then I'm a good human being and God and Allah would be satisfied with me. There is no need for
Allah
me to be
says,
religious.
Allah says to be, you know, he says that you human beings are without any doubt in great loss. But for the people who have illa allazina amanu, who have believed, who have brought, you know, who have iman, who believe. And وَأَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ Allah does not say who only believe. He says who perform amal salih, who perform good deeds.
Okay, imagine.
So performing deeds is
imagine
extremely...
you're living in an environment
okay.
where people are atheists. They don't believe in anything.
Okay.
How do you create a need for religion in them?
They believe that religion is there, but they call Allah as nature.
Mm-hmm.
But they say that this is, you know, nature created.
So everyone
nature
has
said,
a belief and there
every,
is a
this
creed
is intrinsic.
In
this is
There's always an ideology system out there.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you believe in a non-material one or a material one, it doesn't matter. As long as you have an ideology, you're living a lifestyle that's telling you, do this, do that, do this, do that.
Set a rule.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
There's always an ideology system out there. Yeah, it gives you the worldwide view for yourself, and it also gives
But they
you,
don't call it religion.
Don't let them call it religion. No problem. But at the end of the day, the meaning of religion, the spirit of religion, they're doing it.
Asma, I think, see, I wanted to give this example. For example, I as a human being created a refrigerator. I as a human being created a washing machine. And I wrote an instruction book for it. I do not use instruction book of, I as a user, do not use instruction book of refrigerator to use washing machine. Why? Why I don't do that? Because the creator, the discoverer of this washing machine or this refrigerator knew better. He said me... I created this, so I know better. If you use it this way, it will give you service for 4 or 5 years.
Yes, you mentioned a very important point. That's very true. The creator, who is Allah, knows us better, and he has planned a set of rules
I cannot follow someone.
So we have to follow those rules.
Exactly. If you're going to use an instruction book of a refrigerator for your washing machine, that will not give you that service.
That is very
Maybe
true.
Maybe you're going to destroy it.
Yes, thank you. Just to give you the loyal audience of Back to Reality, a gist of what we're talking about, we talked about how to make the needs of religion in a person, and we said that God, Allah has created us in a way that we need to be restricted by some rules. Those rules have to be heavenly and coming from an authority that has been chosen by Allah. Therefore, in order to escape chaos, we have to follow those rules. And at the end of the day, as human beings, we need a light to take us further in our path and journeys. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session, we bid you farewell. I leave you to the protection of God's never-sleeping eyes.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration's reluctance to spend geopolitical capital greenlights Israeli settlement push. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Zionist regime bowed to American pressure and scrapped the controversial Atarot settlement in the Palestinian neighborhood of Ghalandia, just north of Al-Quds. But on the heels of that decision, the regime advanced another Jewish settlement in Palestinian neighborhoods along Al-Quds' southern tip, even as the residents there are grappling with a severe housing shortage. The plan is to develop a new neighborhood called Givat HaShaked on land expanding beyond the Green Line, the Zionist regime's de facto border before the 1967 war, which saw it occupy its Al-Quds, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and adjacent to the Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Safafa in occupied East Al-Quds. Recently, the Al-Quds Municipality Planning and Building Committee recommended the development plan for deposit, meaning it will now head to Al-Quds District Planning Committee, which will decide whether to deposit the plan for objections or public review. The project calls for construction of 473 homes, schools, and synagogues to be built on about 9 acres of open land. During the committee hearing, the Zionist regime's custodian general, the authority within the Justice Ministry overseeing properties whose owners are unknown, was represented by its economic unit director, Hanel Gorfinkel. Gorfinkel is a right-wing activist known for supporting Jewish settlements in East Al-Quds. Givat HaShaked is not the only settlement in East Al-Quds being pushed by the custodian general. Documentation obtained by Haaretz reveals Givat HaShaked is one of 6 Jewish neighborhoods the Zionist regime is currently advancing across East Al-Quds. These include one in Sheikh Jarrah, one near Damascus Gate, one in Sor Bahar, one in Beit Haniya, and another in Beit Safafa. Activists emphasize that Gorenfekel's appointment is directly intertwined with the heightened settlement activity and the displacement of Palestinians in East Al-Quds. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Al-Quds-focused Israeli human rights organization Er Amim, said of Gorfinkel, "What we have seen is that since his appointment in 2017, there has been a substantial increase in eviction lawsuits against Palestinians and the expansion of Jewish settlements in Palestinian areas." According to Er Amim, the acreage set for Givat HaShaked is actually on land that is undergoing formal land registration in Sharafat area of Beit Safafa. The Zionist regime's 2018
Decision 3790 was marketed to the public as a means to push economic development in Istal Quds and reduce socioeconomic inequality. The initiative reserved 50 million shekels, nearly $16 million, for the registration of land rights in Istal Quds, an important prerequisite needed to secure building permits. The Zionist regime authorities often use the absence of building permits as justification for demolishing Palestinian homes. However, as uncovered by Air Amim, land registration procedures are being used to advance Jewish settlements as found in Sheikh Jarrah, rather than develop Palestinian neighborhoods in Al-Quds. On one hand, Decision 3790 is depicted as a tool to aid Palestinians, Cohen told Min Press News, adding, and yet it's being used to further the expansion of Jewish settlement and confiscation of Palestinian land and property. Land registration is supposed to be a transparent and publicized process. Sari Kronish, East Al-Quds planner at Israeli Regime Planning Rights Organization, BIMCOM, explained. The regime is supposed to publish a map of areas of the plots and invite people to make claims. And if claims are made that contradict each other, then the registrar is supposed to send those claims to court to be clarified, Kronish said, adding, but the way the regime is actually doing it, we see that it's being done quietly. People often don't know that's happening. We don't know yet of a single case where the Palestinians will be able to benefit from it, Kronish added. The area reserved for Givat Hashaket was once sought after for development by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In 1995, Rabin put forward a housing project for the land, sparking international outcry. The UN Security Council voted to have the Zionist regime halt the plan, with the United States vetoing the resolution. Rabin shelved his expropriation days after the UN vote, in what has been speculated to be an exchange for the US veto. Now the current Zionist regime is going beyond what any previous leadership dared to. Daniel Scheidman, founder and director of Israeli nonprofit Terrestrial Al-Quds, emphasized. These settlement plans are now on the agenda, Scheidman told Min Press News, adding, relations between the United States and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are charged at the moment. Scheidman continued, the Americans have made their concerns very clear about the settlement of E1 and Atarot, so why is Bennett having another poke in the eye over something like this? Lara Friedman, president of the American Nonprofit Foundation for Middle East Peace, FMEP, agreed the new government is stepping into territory even Bennett's predecessor wouldn't touch. They are as bad as the Benjamin Netanyahu cabinet, and in many ways, they are worse, Friedman said, adding, these settlements are absolutely incompatible with any commitment to anything other than permanent Israeli control over the entire area, Friedman added, highlighting the record number of home demolitions throughout Area C of the occupied West Bank as another way Bennett's cabinet is pushing increased annexation. From Er Amim's Cohen's perspective, despite Bennett's cabinet being a politically diverse coalition, hardline voices are the ones in power. Far-right members of the coalition are put in very strategic high-level positions like in the Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Justice, Cohen said. All of these portfolios are very senior and they have a lot of weight. And what we have seen is because of this, they're quietly able to advance this very far-right wing agenda. prominent right-wing politicians hold top spots in Israel's cabinet. Ayelet Shaked is Interior Minister. Zeev Elkin is the Minister of Housing and Construction. And Gideon Saar serves as the Minister of so-called Justice. As settlement expansion becomes the defining feature of Bennett's regime, the other side of the Atlantic is becoming increasingly more vocal about the Zionist occupation and land theft. In November 26, U.S. House Democrats penned a letter urging Secretary of State Antony Blinken to stop the Zionist regime from moving forward with a settlement plan in E1 area of the West Bank. The move was led by Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, who recently toured a Palestinian village in the West Bank with New York Representative Jamal Bowman. And Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum has become a strong advocate for Palestinian rights in Congress. The Democrat has sponsored two bills related to U.S. military aid to the Zionist regime and said the state practices apartheid. On the Givat HaShaked proposal, an ongoing settlement expansion in Palestine, McCollum told Min Press in a statement, "The Zionist regime's state-sponsored expansion of settlements on Palestinian land, while the Israeli cabinet bureaucrats deny Palestinian permits to even build homes and bulldoze existing Palestinian homes, schools, and businesses, is destroying the prospect of a Palestinian state and the prospects for peace. The global community views the Israeli settlement expansion as illegal and lethal to any future peace process, and the U.S. government should not be silent. The situation has reached a point in which the Palestinians are clearly a people denied even basic human rights while under Israeli regime subjugation. U.S. lawmakers are emerging as more and more critical of Israeli regime, but that hasn't stopped the Israeli regime violence. In fact, the Zionist regime appears almost fueled by the condemnation." But at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights. No U.S. administration wants to be perceived as picking 10 fights every day with Israel, even if Israel is engaging every day in 10 things that really demand a response from the U.S.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.